Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
The calendar told me to call you, so I called you.
Do you do everything the calendar says, Jason?
All hail the calendar.
Calendar, our leader.
It is, yes. Calendar.
That's the plot of a terrible Star Trek episode that never got made, right? Where it turns out there was a secret computer named Calendar, yeah. But it's actually just like a flip calendar.
We must serve. We must follow the schedule. How could you live like that? The schedule is something that human beings aspire to. You choose what to do yourself.
Most illogical.
Mr. Spock, fire phasers at the calendar. No! How will we tell the time? In olden days, man built his own devices for timekeeping. You could do that, too. It's a great Star Trek episode.
This is when Kirk gets court-martialed once again for violating general order number one. It's fine.
No, he's got a
get out of jail free card. He's got a lot of dirt on Starfleet command. Is that what it is?
He's so far out in the 5-year mission that by the time the reports get back, they're going to be like, whatever.
It's a whole light speed problem, relativity.
I think there's somebody in the Prime Directive Bureau who's like, yeah we're going to not do
there's
that.
There's no Prime Directive Bureau. Nobody is maintaining that.
There is. You're going to get slightly political here. There is. It's kind of like the EPA right now, which is they put people in charge of it who don't want to do the job of the organization, right? Who want to undermine it. So the Prime Directive Bureau is like, your planet is stupid. Your civilization is stupid. We're taking care of it. It's like,
I think what you're implying is they put Kirk in charge of the Prime Directive Bureau.
Well, one of his like college pals,
his
like Finnegan.
Yeah, right.
Finnegan is in charge of the Prime Directive Bureau, and he's like, all right, Jimmy boy, do what you want. Yep.
Could have been worse.
That's my
Gary Mitchell.
thank you for coming to my Star Trek TED Talk. Sir, this is a Wendy's. Could I do that? Could I put those together? Anyway. Hi. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
I did watch Star Trek Discovery last night, and it was very original Star Trek-like, which I enjoyed.
Kat was really excited. She turned to me afterwards. She's like, oh my God, that was so TNG. I loved it so much.
Yeah, I mean, it was like an episode where they're on a planet. Anyway, we're not going to talk about Star Trek here. There are other podcasts for that. What's going on? I saw you wrote a Macworld piece that just went up this week about Apple's personnel changes, which I think is really interesting because I was reading, and I haven't done anything about this, but I was reading John Gruber's thing about like, oh, maybe Tim Cook is preparing for a recession or something like that. And I am fascinated to see how people interpret this stuff. And having worked in, I mean, I never worked for a company that was like successful like Apple, right? Our publishing company, anybody in the media business has never worked in a company or industry as successful as Apple. But the way I always read it is that like if you have lots of money and there's a downturn in the economy, you're in a great position because you can keep spending money.
Yeah,
everything's less valuable, and then as the economy turns around, you've invested through the downturn, and you're like really in great position to take advantage, while everybody else is kind of on their heels and reeling. Yeah. And I think about how much money Apple has, and how profitable they are, and how much revenue they generate. And even in a bad economy, I look at it and think, if you are an executive who's going to do hiring freezes or cutting jobs, just because that's what you do in a recession, I think you're bad at your job, right? I think that is, and I can tell you that there were people who were my bosses over the years who were bad at their jobs, who would do sacrificial job cuts just to send a message to the big bosses that oh no, we're taking this seriously. It's like Apple should cut jobs because there are projects they're not interested in doing anymore, right? Like cars, right? Or whatever. But don't like stop hiring engineers because there might be a recession. Because I mean, come on, who are we? You have all the money. You can weather the recession.
You're going to outlast that. Yeah, I think that the people.
Yeah,
The people who point at that is like, oh, look, Apple missed their, you know, results estimate one quarter, and now they're firing a bunch of people. Those people are seeing a cause and effect relationship that does not exist.
Does not
right?
like exist.
They are seeing a two separate things, and they are conflating them. Because
we are so good
no
at that.
Way.
I just finished my reread of William Gibson's novel Pattern Recognition, mm-hmm, which is all about mm-hmm that, right? Like, yeah, we are so good at creating narratives out of nonsense.
Yeah, that's very comforting to us. And in this case, in that specific case where it was that was the Bloomberg story from a couple weeks ago about like Apple slowing hiring in some divisions. And again, like, yeah, that may be the case. Factually, that may be true. But the reasons behind that, I think, are probably more complex than what's being attributed to them, because it's also just a matter of like, it's a matter of timelines, too. Right. Like, they didn't see we're going to miss estimates and then a week later be like, we're going to fire a bunch of people. Right. Like, that was not how that even causality wise. Like, I think the arrow of time might be against you on that one, because I'm guessing they knew probably, you know, or started to have suspicions before they released that information to the public. You know, sort of going through and like adding up the numbers and being like, oh, okay, these don't quite work right. And they weren't making, you know, left-hand, right-hand stuff too, right? Like, they're not talking to each other in that way. Like, you know, Tim Cook doesn't pick up an iPhone from his office and be like, call the HR people, like, immediately let all these people go. We need to save money, yes, right? And to your point, they have a ton of money. There's no way they couldn't survive that.
Yeah, so I'm not saying to be, like, spend money like a drunken sailor. I'm saying you don't need to batten down the hatches. You need to be smart and, in fact, start scooping up people who maybe get let go elsewhere.
Right.
Or your some of your competitors like are distracted, or they have to deal with economic troubles that you don't really need to deal with. You need to worry about your stock price. But like cash at paying employees who are necessary for what happens with the products that are being designed that are going to ride you out of the economic downturn. Like, that is malpractice if you start cutting costs and cutting people who are necessary just to show your, you know, being careful during a potential recession.
The narrative issue there too, right, is that people, why would you look at Apple's track record and anything they have done and assume that they would take the stupidest possible answer, right?
Yeah,
like,
right?
That just doesn't jibe with anything else that you see about the company. So the stuff I was looking at were, you know, not quite, it wasn't that particular story, but it was the stories of, for example, I talked a little bit about John Giandrea, who has been recently added to the executive team,
right,
and how that signals how important Siri and machine learning are to the future of Apple. Because Apple doesn't put a lot of people on its executive team. The last person I think they added, like, not a person who filled a role that was previously on the executive team, but like added in a brand new capacity, I think, was Johnny Cerugi, who does the
chips.
Who's basically in charge of custom silicone.
Yeah.
And custom silicone, clearly incredibly important to Apple, right? So that signals something. When you add somebody to your executive team, you're saying they are like a critical asset, right? And that to me suggests that they are viewing AI, machine learning, Siri, that kind of stuff, as something that will be critical to their success over the next few years. And there shouldn't be any surprise about that, but it is kind of a formal piece of evidence that backs up that speculation that they are focusing heavily on that. So that was like one example I was looking at, especially for Giandrea, because he only joined Apple last April. It hasn't even been there for a year yet. And basically in that time, he went from, oh, you know, we'll put him in charge of, you know, machine learning and AI stuff, to, okay, he's also running Core ML and Siri, to, okay, he's also
on our executive board
team. Yeah, like, that, to me, that is a huge signal.
Yeah, that's right. They've gone through his probationary period, and they're, like, doing great.
Yep, exactly. And, like, this is really important. So that was one. Another was this hiring, which leaked out this week about the guy they hired away from the Samsung SDI division, which makes batteries. So they hired an executive who formerly worked at Samsung's battery division, which is a separate company from the part of Samsung that makes smartphones. But it's that part is also their largest client, obviously, because they buy a crap ton of batteries. But they hired their SVP in charge of, like, basically a next generation battery research. So again, that's a signal, like, look at all the Apple products that involve batteries. Battery technology is extremely competitive right now, because if you can get an edge there, that is something that users care about. Users care about their phones lasting all day, or their AirPods not dying, or their laptops, you know, running 3 days in a row, etc. Like, that is a huge deal. And the problem is, battery technology, while it's advancing, has largely plateaued, because the stuff we're using today, while it's more advanced than the stuff we were using, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, it's not based on anything fundamentally different in terms of like the chemistry involved in it. Like, we're using very, very similar battery technology to what we were using a decade ago. And we've been able to eke a lot more performance out of it, especially Apple with its power management solutions, which is another reason they hired all those people from Dialog Semiconductor who make their power management chips last year. So, like, again, this is an area where you're pointing to, this is something that will be really important to Apple if they're going outside and they're hiring away from a large competitor, which is what they did with John Andrea too, because he came from Google. He was like the head of AI and search at Google. Mm-hmm. So like they picked like who is the best person we could get to run this. And then the third thing to round it out was talking a little bit about the story that's been going around this week about Project Titan. And of course, Project Titan is one of those like totally shrouded in mystery things. Right. This week's story was interesting, though. This is a CNBC report that basically said Apple has dismissed 200 people from its team. And Apple confirmed it, which is incredibly unusual. I can't remember the last time that I saw them come out and like give a like personnel changes. Like that seemed crazy, like that they would just admit to that. Now, it's a big team. The estimates put it somewhere in like it's probably a couple thousand people on that team, at least. And so 200 is a, you know, it's a big percentage, but it's not the bulk of the team. So clearly, you know, they're still working on this stuff. And they referred in their statement several times to like autonomous systems, which I think is what Tim Cook has said in the past too when questioned about it. You know, like we still don't know, are they building a car or planning a car down the road, as it were, or is this all just sort of them experimenting around? It's fascinating though, because like you, even if you can fire 200 people and keep several thousand, you know, a couple thousand people there, like that indicates you are not doing away with that project, right? They haven't shuttered that project. They've perhaps refocused and, from recent reports, reorganized under new leadership. But that's a lot of people to devote to something that you think is maybe just a flash in the pan.
Right. And for my, you know, I was thinking about it from the perspective of their statement about like autonomous systems are important to them and all of that. That the fact is, all of that talk about like, oh, well, don't lay people off during if you think a recession might be coming. But, you know, fundamentally, if you decide, oh, this is not a thing we should, this is not a thing we should do, this part of it is wrong, like, that's what layoffs are for, right? And I was thinking about it in terms of SpaceX had a bunch of layoffs, and people were talking about like, oh, what's going on with Elon Musk's, you know, rocket ship company, spaceship company, for those who don't follow space stuff. And there was a really intelligent piece by Eric Berker, who is the space writer for Ars Technica, a really smart guy, knows his stuff. And he said, the fact is, SpaceX used to have a whole bunch of different rockets in development, and they also were building a whole bunch of rockets as a part of their progression. And they've reached a point where they've got the one of their rockets is in its last configuration, basically. It's reached the point where they're not going to mess with it anymore. Plus, their whole thing is recycling those rockets. They land back you know, on a drone ship or on the ground, and then they refurbish them and they shoot them off again, and they can do that many, many times. So as a result, they don't need as many people in the construction process, and they don't need as many people in the design process, because that thing has reached its final design.
Sure. Yeah.
And they only have one existing, you know, basically rocket design project that they're iterating on right now, when they used to have like three. And it was really interesting, because they're like, you know, you look at the numbers and you're like, uh-oh, something's wrong at SpaceX. They laid off some people. But as you have done with Apple, I mean, there's a lot of complexity that you don't necessarily see if you don't look closely or if you don't know about it. And then you just try to create a narrative about what little you do know. And we're back to pattern recognition again. Truth is,
people getting laid off seems really like, oh, that must be trouble, right? Why do you lay off people unless you're in trouble?
No, exactly. But in the case of SpaceX, it's like they don't need that many people doing those tasks anymore, because their business has changed, because they were doing huge invest in startup and doing five things at once. And now they've kind of, that part of their business has matured. Their Falcon 9 part of their business is basically just, they've got the design, they're, you know, they can build new ones, but they don't need to build a huge volume of them because they're reusing them. And, you know, presumably they will hire when they need to in other areas, right? Which is, that's the other part of it, is that you know, you just because you're laying people off over there doesn't mean you're not hiring somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and that's, it's always, especially with companies that are really cagey about this thing, and most companies are to a certain degree, but, you know, Apple, I don't know about SpaceX as much, but Apple certainly even more so, right? Like, they play their cards extremely close to their chest, so they're not really eager to provide a lot of extra details about what they're doing, especially when it's like a project like Titan, which is clearly, though everybody knows it exists and everybody knows largely what it deals with, nobody really knows specifics of what's coming out of that, if anything. And, you know, we probably won't for another year or two at least. So, yeah, it's interesting to watch people construct narratives around these things.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. I want to point out that the last subhead in your piece for Macworld is the most damn thing ever, because it is not only a groan-worthy pun, but a reference to the TV show Supernatural.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a reference to a song.
To a song, I know, but do you really reference that song other than in the context of Supernatural?
I mean, it's a great song.
Sure. Yes.
And in fact, I think I learned, I mean, I certainly knew of that song before Supernatural, before
yeah.
I even watched Supernatural. But yes, okay. It is inextricably linked with it. So
yes. Okay. Yes. So it's the
go
most
read that.
Thing ever.
Enjoy.
Most damn thing ever is what I'm saying. Yeah. It was the 15th anniversary of my interview with Steve Jobs for the 20th anniversary of the Mac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hold on, let me do some math. Carry the one, move the three.
It's also the 5th anniversary of the interview I had with Phil Schiller and
was that only 5 years ago?
Craig Federighi and all of that about it. Yeah. Well, I thought it was the 25th, but no, it was for the 30th. That I did that interview with them.
That was like 6 months, 7 months before we left, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, okay. I guess I didn't put those that close together in my head.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Me too. I thought that maybe that was the 25th. Anyway, there's a lot of Mac anniversaries is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And I think in 5 years, I'm going to be deeply disturbed by the fact that it will be the 20th anniversary of the 20th anniversary of the Mac. Because, like, again, you know, that was my interview and my cover story, and I've got that issue of Macworld as well as a copy of the first issue framed on the wall in my office. Uh-huh. Because of a thing that was like from the printer at who printed Macworld. There was like, thank you for 20 years of printing Macworld. And when I left, that went from like our old CEO to me, and then now it's in my office here. But that was, again, that was 2004. So that was 15 years ago. So, like, there are those moments where you do the math and you're like, wait a second, half of the life of the Mac is going to be after I interviewed Steve Jobs. That's weird. And that's literally the only time I interviewed Steve Jobs. I asked him a couple of questions in Q&As during media events back when they did Q&As, which is also kind of laughable when you think about it. That was my interview with him. But it's the Mac's 35th birthday. I think what I didn't write, which I if I've been thinking about it, you know, because again, as we've detailed, I think on this podcast, when you write a weekly column, you really, any idea you can latch on to, you latch on to it. The one I could have done would be like, I mean, I've written versions of it. It's like, I feel like the Mac in 5 years is not going to resemble the Mac today. Like, this is the Mac is entering its third, I would say, era. And we don't all know what it's going to be like, but I feel pretty strongly that we're going to, historically, you're going to look back and you're going to say there was the classic Mac era from 84 to 2001-ish, 2001. And then there was the OS X era. And at some point in the next 5 years, probably in the next year or two or three, we're going to probably draw a line and say now we're in the whatever this next era is.
Post OS X. Yeah, we're at that inflection point. I agree. And it's going to be, we've talked about this in the past, it's going to be an interesting year, I think, for the Mac.
Yeah.
And we'll see exactly how that shakes it. Like, they could basically all, I think the question that you and I and most people have is kind of like timelines, right? It's like they could decide to shake a lot of stuff up this year, or they could decide to adjust a few things this year in the anticipation of being more dynamic changes next year. But I think what we agree on is that change is coming one way or another.
Totally.
We just don't know kind of how much and when.
And if you're somebody who identifies with the Mac and doesn't really identify with iOS or more with iOS, I think you're going to... The challenge is that I think Apple recognizes rightly that the future is full of people who've identified with iOS. and not as many people who identify closely with the Mac. So there's a huge advantage in making the Mac something that can do what the Mac does, but be more familiar with the most important part of Apple's product line, which is iOS, because the iPhone is so huge and even the iPad sells better than the Mac does at this point. Yeah. And that is a hard thing to do. Although what I'm finding, and I remember saying this on a podcast a while ago, which is the biggest transitions are the ones where when you hear about them, you think that's impossible. And by the time you get there, it's like you don't even notice because it's not a big deal, because you've already kind of come across and it's like, oh no, cable TV will never be, or streaming TV will never be, right? Like, and then whatever. Landlines are irrelevant now. How could you ever lose your telephone? Well, just wait.
I mean, I remember where I was when I was writing a story about like the Intel Mac transition. You know, it was that seemed so antithetical to me as a person who had grown up with the Mac in the 90s, where that was, you know, that was the enemy, right?
Right.
Like Intel, they were the bad guys, right?
We were
smoking them in ads and all that stuff. And,
sure.
And it was, you just sort of sat there going like, how would this even work? This is crazy. And then you know, it was fairly seamless as transitions go. And, you know, now it's been 13 years or so since I think the first one started rolling out. Like, we've probably spent, you know, more time. We certainly spent more time on OS X on the Intel platform than on the PowerPC platform.
Sure.
But there will come a point where we will have much longer on probably on Intel chips than on, you know, any previous chip.
Yeah, yeah. No, we're basically at that point now where a chip transition would be in the same amount of time. Yeah, and so for me, I think about it now, and like, if you had asked me 5 years ago, 3 years ago about like Mac becoming more like iOS, I'd be like, I don't know. But now, like, I use the iPad more and more. There are things about it now. It's starting to tip over from being like, I can manage, to being like, there's stuff I can do better on iOS than on the Mac. There are also lots of things I can only do on the Mac. I want to be clear about that. But I have those moments where I think, yeah, that would actually be kind of nice. And so my Macworld piece this week was kind of like me thinking, well, what's gonna really make people freak out? I mean, I was kind of thinking about that. I was thinking like all of these UI conventions that Apple could bring to the Mac. And the fact is, they've already brought a lot of iOS UI conventions to the Mac, including full screen and split view. I suggested doing slide over as a concept. I keep thinking about using a trackpad. You know, two-thirds of the Macs sold are laptops, so they all have trackpads. And I think most of the desktops, you know, you can get it with a mouse or a trackpad, but like a lot of people have the Magic Trackpad, that introducing lots of touch gestures that are similar to the ones on iOS, where you swipe from the right to bring up a slide overview, and you say to yourself, but wait, Jason, that's where Notification Center is. Sure, but Notification Center on iOS is on the top, so you're going to swipe down from the top to bring down Notification Center. And maybe the menu bar in the upper right hand corner gets kind of like recast as Control Center, which might be actually a nicer interface, and also maybe
it's
a more
way
touch,
better on the Mac than it is on the iOS devices.
A touch friendly, well, yeah, except it's like the parade of icons and stuff. Like, and if you have down,
it's,
and
it's UI, it's more friendly UX wise, right? Like, that's the biggest problem I know people when they relocated Control Center on their iPhones. It's like, it's annoying to reach up there if you're using
that's
one
true.
Hand. Doesn't matter on the Mac, right? Like,
right,
that's not an issue.
You can do whatever. So I was trying to envision that, mostly just thinking to myself that I suspect Apple is gonna keep going down that route, and I think in the end it'll probably be okay. I have joked, well, half joked on many occasions, or at least I think people were expecting that what I was saying was a joke, but I'm not entirely, I'm not saying I'm gonna draft this or something, but I've been championing the idea that OS X, you know, it's Mac OS now, right? That the versioning and the branding is all kind of a mess, and that I thought they were going to try to sync it up with iOS, and they didn't. But I'm going to come back to it again, which is, I kind of feel like part of this is going to be a syncing up of iOS and Mac OS. And I'm not saying, I mean, somebody was like, surely they're not going to release version 13 because it's bad luck. And I thought, well, that's dumb. That's a superstition. Maybe they will avoid it. But I the thing that I keep thinking is, if I were Apple, I would try to sync up iOS and Mac OS in terms of messaging, and whether that's saying this is iOS and macOS, you know, 2019, or whether it's iOS and macOS 13. I think maybe that's the maybe that is coming. Maybe that's the idea. Like,
I mean,
why if they're so similar and they're trying to be on a lot of, they've said, like, technically they're trying to do a lot of things in the base OS to get them back together so that there's one base OS, because they've kind of drifted apart. Like, at one point, would it not make sense to just say all of our platforms are moving in lockstep, and that is with a you know, a designation, a number that is the same? And so when I say macOS 13 and iOS 13 coming this fall, I'm kidding, but I'm also kind of not kidding.
Well, it's interesting, right, dude, because they actually did this with tvOS.
Exactly.
Because tvOS is at 13 or 12 or whatever, and it's like, it definitely didn't go through 12 versions.
No,
like, there
no,
was
no,
not
they
that many
decided
revisions
to sync it with iOS. And you could do it with watchOS too if you wanted to. I'm not sure whether you want to have the numbers in the teens and whether you like that or not, or whether there's a new numbering scheme that they're trying to do. You
could jump all a fun code name.
You could seriously jump them all to just 19 if you wanted to, or in the year 2020, which is coming up, you could you could be, follow me here, Dan, double X.
Yeah, I feel like I get into
20,
trouble 10 years
iOS
later.
20.
You're going to be into some trouble.
Yes, yeah, maybe.
Well, it is constantly hilarious to me that we're still on macOS 10, technically, even though, like, you know, that
version
number,
10.14. Yeah,
yeah, like that. It makes zero sense to be still on 10 point something when, you know, that's all just sort of a cap over from classic macOS.
It makes 0.14.2 sense.
I mean, the only thing worse than this are version numbers in, like, open source community. So I was looking at some software. We have like a Media Wiki installation for our Mystery Hunt team, and I was looking at updating it and realizing, like, I could not figure out if it's like, oh, 1.5, but our version's on 1.24, and I was like, well, 1.5 surely is higher than 1.24, and I realized no, it's just incrementally counting up from 1.1, and then it just keeps going. And so 1.24 is not version 4 of version 2, it's version 24. And I was like, Oh, that's madness. Anytime I try to look up version numbers of Linux operating systems and they have three different numbers and I don't, like, I'm sure there's a logic to it. I think it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. I think communication wise, like, if you want to communicate that, leaving numbers aside and marketing aside, if you want to communicate that your platforms are moving in lockstep and that they are using the same fundamentals and apps are moving between them and all of that, even if you're keeping iOS and macOS as designations, because there are going to be variants with different rules, just like tvOS is.
Yep.
But they've got a lot of fundamentals in common. Having them be named different things with different schemes, I mean, version numbers, nobody cares about it, but, like, even if you say, well, we have iOS 13 and macOS Mojave, it's like, why do you do that? Why
right
do you not? And they could say, we're now, next time we're gonna do I'm trying to think of a place name, let's just say Monterey, for this fall we're going to release iOS and macOS Monterey.
Right. Yeah,
they could
exactly
do that too.
That
and the
option.
Numbering could still be 10.15, or it could be 13 or whatever. But I'm just saying, why complicate your message about platforms that are now synced up and moving in lockstep by giving them different versions?
There is an argument. I mean, as much as I roll my eyes a little bit at the year-based numbering, there's an argument for it, at least in the sense that, like, it does seem like Apple is committed to releasing a substantial update every year, and if you're going to do that, that certainly makes it easy to figure out.
Yeah, iOS 19.
Yeah, like, you know, I mean, in Windows, obviously, I think the biggest problem with Windows was always, like, they couldn't decide how they wanted to brand anything, and they tried literally everything. And yeah, that was kind of its own mess. I don't know, you know, there's downsides to that too, right? Because, like, it immediately makes things seem dated when they're old. And it also, if you do decide to skip a year, it potentially gets, you know, that has its own branding downsides. But, you know, it comes with its upsides as well. I agree, though, that the having everything on its own separate numbering is kind of frustrating and strange, because you have to remember stuff, right? Like, I can't remember which watchOS we're on, because it doesn't line up with, like, the series of the watch or anything like that. So it's like, yeah, it's whatever the series was. So yeah
well, we'll see. You know, it's all bets are off. It's actually kind of great, right? But I keep anticipating that WWDC is going to be enormous. It may be, like you say, which is, it may actually be a little bit disappointing, because we are anticipating a change that's probably going to take multiple steps, and that they're not going to just drop like, oh, here's everything now, right? It's going to be like, here's what we want to ship now, and this is where we're going, and then I suppose that gives us fodder for writing and talking about it for another year, because we'll get incremental information, but it still won't be the whole picture, and then there'll be like, you know, maybe there's ARM Macs that come, and then there's, you know, another OS wave that follows after that, and like, this is, because I mean, when I say 5 years, like, I think it probably is going to take 5 years for this all to shake out. I think in 5 years, the products that Apple makes are going to be radically different than they are now.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's all going to be a switch that gets slipped in on June the 2nd or whatever.
It has been part of my hesitancy. Like, I've been hesitant to update my MacBook Air, which is like slowly kind of losing the thread, as it were. And I keep thinking, oh, maybe I'll upgrade this. And I think, man, I really want to know how this year's WWDC shakes out before I decide. There may not be anything like that. May not have any news that impacts that decision. But it might. You don't know. So I'm kind of holding off on that front, at least for the next 6 months. And then we'll see.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we will, as always, see. If we survive, indeed, we will see.
Not a given.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know. I feel like this is a pretty great episode of The Secret Podcast, if I do say so myself. I think we covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah, we covered it Apple is nice stuff. To, we covered to, Star Trek.
It's to really chat with you about this stuff in this context, too, because, you know, you and I both do podcasts, but we don't do tech podcasting together, except
that's
here.
Right. Yeah, so this is our catch-all opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. On when Kalendar tells us to meet, I am one with Kalendar.
I will not go to the second page of the Kalendar with you.
Leave your calendars behind, people. Move forward in a with time has no meaning.
Wow, only Kirk humanity got philosophical. Matters.
Mr. Spock, Fireface. that's how that works. I'm like,
damn it, Jim.
In the words of Scott McNulty, Captain Kirk thinks your civilization is stupid, which really is a great summary of every Star Trek episode. It's great. I love it. Captain Picard is very worried about your feelings in your stupid civilization. That's slight difference with the next generation.
He's got some compassion. He's got
Feels very. He's very concerned about the feelings of the people who are trapped in these stupid civilizations.
I loved. By the way, I think our friend Lisa Schmeiser posted this. There's an interview with Jonathan Frakes, I think at Vulture.
Yeah, old Two Take Frakes.
I love the two things I love that. One is that there are people who just call him Frakes, as we used to call our colleague Dan Frakes.
Yes.
We used to just call him Frakes. Second, I really love the tidbit where he's talking about directing First Contact, and this was his first time working on like film, and he's like, oh, we gotta blow up a town. What are you guys gonna use? Like a couple M80s and like a garden out back? And they kind of look at him and they go, no, we're gonna build a town and we're gonna blow it up. Because this is movies.
This is what we do.
Money for it.
Yeah,
I love that. It's great. He seems like a genuinely nice fellow. Somewhere I feel like I have a picture of him, like with him and Dan Frakes, because he showed up, I think, at Macworld or something.
I think so. And we finally got that the amazing
Frakes
connection.
Frakes, yeah.
Well, because Dan, what is it? Jonathan Frakes's dad was a professor where Dan went to school or something like that at UCLA.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And so he had met his dad. And they did the, I think this is the story. Forgive me, Dan Frakes, if I got this wrong, but like he met his dad because it was one of those like, Frakes, yeah. But hadn't met Jonathan Frakes. And then I think you guys met Jonathan Frakes on the floor at Macworld Expo 1 year. And it was finally Dan Frakes and Jonathan Frakes they came together.
Yeah, there's a picture of it somewhere, which was pretty amazing.
There is. And we'll turn that into a Riker meme.
A Riker meme, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Riker Googling. All right. Well, thanks to everybody for being a supporter of Six Colors and all the stuff we do. The tech analysis is what you're paying for, and the Star Trek comes for free. Let's just throw that in. Yeah. All right. Kalendar will make us return here in seven suns.
In seven cycles, we shall return and do the bidding of Kalendar.
All hail Kalendar. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.